And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Welcome back to the Daily Profcast.
Today we're going to be looking at Goblet of Fire, chapters 21, 22, and 23. We decided to end at the Yule Ball today. It's a good place to end.
It is a good place to end. And these were three, I thought, fun chapters. One chapter I didn't care so much about and two other chapters that I really liked.
I mean, yeah, of course, with the Yule Ball, like, it's very exciting.
It is very exciting and things happen. So what really amazed me rereading these three chapters is how similar some of the patches of dialogue are to the movie, but then how completely different the story is in some ways than kind of the flow of the movie.
I agree. I think I also thought that was fun.
Yeah. So it was interesting after experiencing movie Yule Ball so many times.
They did a great job on in the film.
Oh my gosh, yes. And it's beautiful. And I do like some of the changes that they made. And I think it just cinematically makes sense. But it was very cool to experience book canon Yule Ball.
Yule Ball. Totally. Absolutely.
Right.
So we'll get there in the last chapter. But first, we start out in chapter 21, the House Elf Liberation Front, which is kind of a funny name for the chapter. We'll get into why that's the name for the chapter, but this is just coming out of the first task, and Harry goes back to the common room, and of course, you know, the Gryffindor common room is in an uproar. They're having this huge party. Fred and George went and got food from the kitchens. They have introduced their new canary creams.
Oh, goodness.
Which turns you into a canary. Poor Neville is something, victim of a canary cream.
Something on Fred and George that I like, and we're going to see it over the next two books, is the way we're slowly being introduced to Weasley's wizard Weezes.
Yes.
And just like how you kind of just get these like little bits. And it's always just such fun comic relief.
Totally.
In serious moments.
Absolutely. And this is when Harry, you know, is a little bit peer pressured to open the golden egg, which has the clue. And Hermione's kind of like, you know, you're not supposed to open it with other people. You're not supposed to get help in figuring out the clue. Little does she know that's not going to be an issue, because he opens the egg and it starts screaming.
Right.
Exactly like in the movie.
Also funny that Hermione said this after helping him with his summoning charm.
Yes, and he points that out.
Right, which I was like, good on Harry for pointing that out, because it's so Hermione to say something like that, but then be unable to, like, separate herself from Harry emotionally and helping him.
Right. And she was like, because she was the one helping him for the first task. So there's something really sad that...
Yes, there's a couple of sad things. I think we probably have the same thing written down.
Do you want to say it?
Yeah, so, I mean, I wrote kind of a few things on this. So when he opens the egg, it's this, like, terrible scream. I think if you've seen the movie, it's probably a great visual, or, you know, a great audio
auditory representation of probably what this is.
Thank you for those good words. But I thought it was interesting as Seamus mentions that it sounds like a banshee, which from Prisoner of Azkaban was Seamus's boggart.
Yes.
And then poor Neville thinks it sounds like
someone being tortured.
Somebody being tortured. And so he says, oh, maybe you're going to have to deal with the Cruciatus curse in the task. And that's just so sad for Neville, like the subconscious of what has happened to his parents and how it is bubbling up in his life.
Right. And we still don't, like a first time reader to this book, as the books were coming out, before you know the whole story, even through the films and whatnot, we still don't, like, if you're just coming to this, you still don't know, like, what's up with Neville and the Cruciatus curse? Like, he had this, like, weird reaction in the class, and then now he's talking about how this sounds like somebody's getting tortured from the Cruciatus curse. And it begs the question, was he in the vicinity when his parents were being tortured?
I really hope not. I, like, don't even want to think about that as being a possibility. Of course, we know that Harry is an infant, not really truly an infant, I mean, of memory age,
like 18 months,
which means Neville would have been the same age aroundabouts.
Yeah, so it's
not a little older.
Right, it just says that, like, at the end of the war, So yeah, around that time, probably up until the end of the year, maybe. There are some people that have speculated that maybe it was a couple years after, but because we don't get an exact timeline, it just says like towards the end of the, you know, when the war was ending. So yeah, Neville would have been around the same age. And if Harry has memories, you know, all the way back there of his parents getting killed, it begs the question, was Neville there? We don't know.
No, we don't really know. It's so sad. I mean, they're incomparable events, but they make me sad for different reasons, I think, if that makes sense. But then George delivers us some comedic relief, which saying that the egg sounds like Percy singing.
Yeah. And Percy, we're going to see Percy again in these few chapters. And he's still Percy kind of a doofus.
Never disappoints me in the totally asinine things that he says.
Yes. Right. Yeah. He's, yep. And then, so Hermione, like, innocently, you know, comes up to, I don't remember if it's Fred or George, sorry. Sometimes the twins get gooped together in my head. But she's like, you know, oh, did you get these snacks from the kitchens? They're like, yeah, of course we did. She's like, how did you get there? Like trying to find out how to get into the kitchens to see the house elves. He's like, oh yeah, you just find the painting with the bowl of fruit and you tickle the pear. Wait, why? I really wish this bit had been in the movie. Would have been so good to see them go into the kitchens and see the house elves.
Probably too for costs at the time. They might have not been able to incorporate. Like, we don't see Winky ever.
Yeah, that's it's a lot of VFX to get a bunch of house elves on screen.
Right, and CGI was quite expensive at the time. So, yeah, so we do like, see...
We either get the horntail or we get the house elves.
Right.
We can't do both.
We see Hermione sort of prodding on how to get down there. I also think it's great that Fred and George are like, cool with the house elves and just go and get food whenever they want.
Yes, and we can talk about how it can be seen as pretty problematic that the house elves are like, we love being slaves.
Oh, it's problematic.
It's totally problematic. It is, we shouldn't ignore that, but if we do just momentarily, it is cute that they're like buddies with the elves. You know, that the elves are like, yes, we want to give you food.
Which
but anyway.
I find less fault with Fred and George, I suppose, than just with the author and the terrible way in which she wrote.
Exactly.
And there's so many things about the elves.
Right. There's a little bit of deviation from it. We're going to get to Dobby in a second, but actually very soon. They have, the next time they have Care of Magical Creatures, Rita Skeeter's there.
Right. And Ron makes, again, we call out Ron's astute observations when he makes them, but he's the first to wonder and really to say, why is she on campus? Dumbledore has banned her from being here. How did she get back on campus? And so your first time reading this, you're thinking security is really not that great at Hogwarts.
Well, it's not, but also.
But if we kind of take a step back and we think about it, even if maybe this is your, I don't know, we always say spoilers are a thing here and there's no way to get around them. But if we can think back to times in which people who should not have been at Hogwarts got on Hogwarts grounds, we have Wormtail, Animagus, Rat, and Sirius, Padfoot, Black Dog. And so, you know, it kind of is, we're leaving little breadcrumbs here to, how can Rita Skeeter get back on campus if she's been supposedly banned? And you would think security's probably quite heightened because of the tournament and because of what happened at the World Cup. So it's kind of an interesting little tidbit.
Yeah, absolutely. And then they go to divination and Trelawney predicts Harry's death again, like she always does. But now that section in the beginning that you pointed out, McKenna, where she was like, were you born midwinter? Did you have like a tragedy early in life? Where she wasn't really seeing like Harry's aura or whatever. She was seeing Tom Riddle's.
Right.
And now I keep thinking like every time she does this, you know, and the thing she says, it's like, you have to take into account if Trelawney's like, if she's BSing or if it's actually a real prediction.
She's such an unreliable narrator.
Right. Right. So now every time she says something like this, I'm like, are you sensing Harry or are you sensing like the bit of Tom Riddle in Harry?
Right. And I think these
it's made me look much more closely at the things she says now.
Yes. And that's what's really interesting, I think, about Trelawney in general as a character is that there's so much that clouds all of the really astute and good parts about her, that she's just so fuzzy and so gray when you're looking at, you know, is she really talented at what she does, or is she just like completely wacky? So I agree. I think it's interesting. I also think that in some ways, Harry's a pretty easy person to predict his death, because he just has a habit of constantly getting involved in like insane things. Some his fault, some not his fault.
Right. Should we get to the kitchens?
Yeah.
So Hermione isn't at dinner one night, and the boys are like, okay, kind of weird. Maybe she's just in the library. And then they're walking back to the common room, and Hermione's like, oh my gosh, come quick, come quick. So they follow her down to what we now know. I mean, not now, but like what we will find out eventually is the way to the Hufflepuff common rooms. So the Slytherin common rooms are in the dungeons, or near the dungeons, and the Hufflepuff common rooms are on the lower floors as well, whereas Gryffindor and Ravenclaw are up in their own towers. So they descend some stairs into this.
What kind of house preference is that? Let's make half of the student body sleep in the basement. And the other ones can sleep up in this cool tower of the castle.
Yeah, but the Hufflepuffs are near the kitchens.
Right, which also is problematic, as the Hufflepuffs are often like alluded to being like
the stoner house.
And not even just a stoner house. I more think like, you know, like chubby, loafy.
It's cute, like pudgy.
Pudgy, yeah, which is just like.
Yeah. Like when you see someone and you're like, you're so adorable, I just want to squish you. Like that's
sometimes just like the way the author chose to separate the children and the ways that they are, it just frustrates the
Yeah, it's completely frustrating. Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, you're right that this is the way to this Hufflepuff
the kitchens.
Common room.
Yeah, so it's on the way to the Hufflepuff common room, and the kitchens are right there, and they come upon this big painting with the bowl of fruit. Harry and Ron are like, uh-oh, I know where this is going. And Hermione tickles the pair, and they get let into the kitchens. And what Hermione was freaking out about in the kitchens is who should be there but Dobby.
Dobby, a free elf.
Who now works at Hogwarts for a wage.
Right. There's a lot to unpack about the house elves.
Yeah.
So we get reintroduced to Winky. She's also there working. She has refused a wage, because she feels so ashamed that she's been freed. She misses the Crouches terribly, and sort of, I've said the word allude a lot today in this already in the 10 minutes we've been recording, but she sort of alludes to the Crouches. So there's something not being right, and that Mr. Crouch must be very stressed without her, and that something is sort of off there, which she's right. It's an astute observation. There is something off with the Crouches, and particularly Barty Crouch Sr. Another thing to note here is the continuation of just this vernacular that,
yes,
now that we've spoken about it, it just really bothers me to read it.
It's very, again, I know that the author is English, but to an American, this reads like caricaturized, hyperbolic, like
slave
speech, but not like actually slave speech, like historically, like how the media would like hyperbolize slave speech.
Right.
It's really weird to like old like Aunt Jemima commercials that you look at now and you're like, that's really messed up, like how, you know, It's as an American, this reads like that, and it's really weird, and it makes me uncomfy.
Right, and I think that the author is educated enough to know what they did here. I just don't, considering all of her other problematic behavior, I'm not sure that this is just a coinkydink.
Yeah, it's like, it really bugs me that regardless, this is the way the house, and it's mostly, like, I honestly didn't notice this so much when Dobby was introduced as a character. Like, Dobby's thing is he talks about himself in the third person, and all elves kind of do that. But other than that, his language isn't really like this, but Winky's really is.
But it's interesting to see the way that the language is associated to the particular character, because Dobby, we see him as almost enlightened. He mm-hmm. enjoys being free. He finds friendships with, you know, the humans. He helps Harry. He's a big part of Harry's like eventual defeat of Voldemort. But Winky, in sort of what we view as a problematic way in which the author has her speaking, I see it as very much attached to her intelligence, because she doesn't want to be freed. She likes being enslaved. And like the connotation is that she is just so much like less intelligent. And then to have her speaking in the way that she does, in a way that just feels so offensive when I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, this is maybe like not my thing to be offended at, but it is, it just reads like very offensively to me. And it really bothers me when I read it. And I don't think I ever noticed it before this reread, which just tells you that, I don't know, like we have privilege to not have to care about these things.
Yeah.
And when, once you kind of are like awoken to that, it's very jarring.
I think, you know, sometimes I wonder like how much of the, this sounds really weird, but like the time period makes a difference. Cause like I want, did people first reading these books in like the early 2000s take these kind of issues, or were they just kind of like, oh yeah? Cause like, I wouldn't have noticed this as a child, but like adults reading this, I wonder if they were like, huh? Like it's a little bad.
If you have any listeners who are people of color who would like to
weigh in,
send us an email or leave us a voice note or send us an Instagram DM. I would really very specifically like to hear your opinions about this, because of course, like we're just two white people talking about this. And I think it's an interesting point to raise, but our voices don't really matter in this particular conversation. And so I would just be really intrigued to hear somebody else's perspective on this. And if you're comfortable with us, like if you leave us a voice note and you're comfortable with us putting it in the show, we can do that. Otherwise, we can kind of rediscuss this in a future episode and kind of like bring up whatever you've written us or anything.
Yeah, particularly
if you feel comfortable.
Totally. Particularly, I think if you're a listener who's Black.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear your perspective on this, because to us, this reads sort of offensively.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just don't like the connotation between the way she speaks and then her thoughts about herself being free. I just hate it so much.
Yes. And where they're like house elf, like race, and like typically what they do for work comes into play. It's just, yeah, it's icky.
It does make me feel icky. It rubs me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but she does say something important. She's talking about how Mr. Crouch used to tell her that Mr. Bagman was really bad. It was a bad guy. He didn't like him. And the trio's kind of like, Ludo Bagman's like this kind of harmless, dopey dude. Like,
yeah, why? He's an idiot, but he's not dangerous.
Yeah, like he's not bad. Yeah, exactly. So like, why? Maybe Crouch just thinks he's bad at his job, which would make sense. But they're kind of like, that's a little weird. And then the chapter ends kind of sweet with Dobby, though. He's like, can Dobby come and see you sometimes, sir? To Harry, which is just...
And boy, does he come see him.
Yeah, but it's just so, like, Harry does not appreciate Dobby's friendship enough. He's such a sweet friend to Harry. I mean, yeah, he, like, almost got him killed a couple times second year. Like, I get it. In an attempt to save his life. But, like, he's very sweet to Harry.
Right. I think this chapter is also important because I think Hermione is sort of becoming more aware of the complexities in her fight for mm-hmm. the freedom and liberation of house elves, in that they don't, they don't really view their own freedom as something that's important. They very much like the work that they do. And that's not to say that they shouldn't, number one, be paid a living wage for what they're doing,
yeah,
and not be master or not be servants to a master. But I think she's starting to be a little bit more aware that this is not so cut and dry. And she kind of says to Harry and Ron that she's hoping Dobby working there and being paid a wage, even if it's only, was it one galleon
a week?
A week.
He says he talked Dumbledore down from 10 galleons a week.
Right.
Which is, again, I'm like, ooh.
So she's hoping that him being there working in the kitchens will inspire the other house elves to see, you know, how happy Dobby is and want the same things.
Totally.
Kind of just bothers me in general that Dumbledore, like, doesn't have any incentivized work, like any incentives or compensation for the work that the house elves have been doing for many generations while working
right
there.
And it's like, you know, you can explain it away very easily as the author being like, well, they don't want it, like they just want to do their work and like not get paid for it. But like, I don't know, you would think, especially like being alive in a time where, you know, not only the United States but the UK has experience, like particularly the UK with imperialism, has experience with like slavery and enslaving people. And like, I just think being, even in the, you know, the early 2000s when this was written, like being alive in a time where that is a part of your country's history, you would think that like a decent character in a novel would be like, well, I understand that this is like typically how your class or your, you know, your race is treated, but I'm going to pay you anyway.
Right.
Like, no, they don't want it. Like,
it's very frustrating that this has to be the plight of a teenager, you know, to raise awareness about. And people who are exploited don't always know that they're, you know, being exploited until they understand that there's an alternative way of life that is acceptable. And in this case of the house elves, we see that they've been conditioned over a very long period of time to believe that they should be happy working for free and that this is the only way to achieve happiness. Just very disturbing situation overall.
Yeah, it is. And like I understand that Hermione is like fighting against it, but the fact that she's the only character like coming from like growing up as a muggle, like sensing that there's something wrong with this is a little wacky. It's not a little wacky. That's putting it lightly. It's bad. So anyway, that's messy. On to chapter 22.
Right. One more thing in this chapter is that just a recall to the first book. If anybody remembers, I just think it's cute. Dumbledore mentioned to Harry that James spent a large portion of time at Hogwarts sneaking down to the kitchens and stealing food.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, it's just something cute.
That is cute. And now he knows how to get down there.
Exactly, now he knows how to do it.
He should have known how to do that from, you would think the map would, if James spent a lot of time sneaking down there, you would think the map would, well, but if there's not like a secret passageway and he was just.
He has an invisibility cloak and he has a map of the school. I just think.
Yeah, like what?
Just so many plot holes consistently. Like, you're telling me he never, well, I guess.
Watch maybe Fred and George go down there.
Right. And I guess maybe this shows Harry's nature, that he's just like so content and happy with what he has at Hogwarts, that he's not very greedy about things, that he never thought to go down there and steal food. But
that's fair.
I find it hard to believe that after like a particularly grueling Quidditch practice, he wouldn't just, you know, want to go down and steal like a little snacky for himself.
Yeah. Yep. So chapter 22, The Unexpected Task.
This
is a funny. I'm sorry. I said we were going to find out why this is called the House of Liberation Front. That the only reason chapter 21 is called that is because Ron like deliberately messes up the name of Spew. He's like, that's like why it's called, it's kind of weird. So now on to chapter 22, The Unexpected Task, which is a funny name.
This is a great chapter.
A great chapter.
Like a really quality chapter. It's funny. It's just so endearing seeing these kids grow up into teenagers and have all their like puberty feelings.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's like watching like little siblings grow up and you just see them like hit their awkward phase and it's just funny. And gosh, this chapter brought me a lot of joy.
Yep. Same. Yeah. Particularly like this being from Harry's perspective. And Harry's just already awkward. So just, yeah, it's funny.
So in Transfiguration class, Professor McGonagall tells the class that part of this whole Triwizard Tournament experience is that there's going to be a ball on Christmas Day. Kind of an inconvenient time to have a ball should people have wanted to go home and spend time with their families.
Yeah, I'm like, especially the foreign students.
Right. And they kind of mentioned that the school empties out, but I'm guessing everybody like goes home.
Decided to stay, yeah.
Well, so people probably went home and then came back for the ball, which I guess, because they say the school is emptier for a time, kind of like before Christmas,
I think what that is referring to is normally the school is emptier, but this year it's really packed during the Christmas holiday. Yeah, it's just hilarious. So McGonagall's like, yeah, there's going to be a Yule ball. And then she calls Harry up after class and she's like, you and your date are going to have to start off the dancing since you're one of the champions. And he's like, I'm sorry. Two things in that sentence that I take issue with: date and dancing. She's like, yeah, you're going to need to get a date. He's like, I don't dance and I don't. And she's like, suck it up and go, you know, figure it out. And just watching Harry navigate like being around girls who aren't Hermione Granger is just very funny.
And so we know, we've picked up on it, that Harry has a crush on Cho. Mm-hmm. And so for most of this chapter, he's trying to pluck up enough courage to ask her, you know, to the ball.
Right. And that's like, you know, like you said, he's trying to pluck up the courage. So he's obviously nervous and like awkward about it. And other girls are asking him. Actually, right. Because now that he's, you know, because he did well, he was pretty unpopular after his name was pulled, but after he did so well in the first task, now he's, you know, he's got a little bit of, you know, people are more on his side.
He has
now.
A little clout.
Right. He's noticing that, like, it's not the entire school, like, feeling like the entire school's against him, like, before the first task, now that he's done really well. And some of these girls are asking him, I just want to say, there was one girl who asked him, and apparently this girl is really tall and the boys are teasing him about the fact that this girl asked him, and he goes, she was a foot taller than me. Imagine what I'd look like trying to dance with her. And I just want to say, ouch, as a tall girl. Thanks a lot, Harry. More importantly, thanks a lot, Joanne. Rude.
I know, the body standards, ridiculous.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, you know, he's not like dead set on asking Cho. Like he wants to ask Cho, but he's sort of like scrambling a little bit for a couple days. Like, I just need to ask a girl and I don't really know what to do. And I'm like, what? Shouldn't Hermione have been his first thought? Like, as friends?
Yeah, no.
Like, we see this again sixth year, the Slug Club.
Yeah.
Like, why isn't this just his first thought if he doesn't want to like go through the awkwardness of asking somebody he's like not that close to?
Yeah, it's... The whole thing is so awkward. And the person who's having a worse time than Harry is Ron.
Yeah.
And that's because Ron has such a tude.
He does. And and he also has this weird like competition with Hermione when he finds out who she's going with and that she's going with somebody at all. There is this funny bit of dialogue that makes it into the film from the book. And it's like, you know, why do they always travel in packs? Like, it's really hard to ask a girl when you can't get her alone.
So funny and true.
True. Actually, you know, that is a stereotype, but it's also can confirm.
Yeah, we do travel in packs, especially to the bathroom.
Yes. And the you know, Hermione's kind of pressing Harry on working on the egg, the clue on the egg, because the second task is coming up. And he's like, I've got till February 24th. I've got time. There's so much
time. I had a long time in between tasks. I suppose I didn't really realize that was the time in between tasks, because the movie obviously just picks up so quick.
Yep. And people are buzzing about the fact that the Weird Sisters are going to be there. There's kind of a funny story about JKR and the Weird, using the band title, the Weird Sister, but Weird Sisters, because there's a real band called the Weird Sisters that like sued her and I think Scholastic for copywriting their band name. I think they ended up changing the spelling to make it not copyright, but there was like a little bit of a legal snafu with that. You can look it up on the internet if you're interested. And the boys are just kind of scrambling to ask people. Fred asks Angelina, and then one day they just decide, you know, we're going to come back to the common room tonight and we're both going to have dates. Just ask someone. And Ron makes this comment, because we don't want to like end up going with a quote pair of trolls. If you are a teenage boy, if you are an anybody, don't ever talk about women like this. I don't think even making, like, I don't even think letting your book characters talk about women like this, even though you're like, well, that's what boys do. It's locker room talk. Like, they do, because we keep perpetuating it. Like, can we not have people talk about women like this, please?
Right. It's disappointing. And like you said, of course, we can explain it away. Like, oh, they're 14, 15-year-old boys. This is what 15 and 14-year-old boys do. But I think if you're going to have these kind of things in your story, like, they have to have a resolution in which the characters realize that what they've done is wrong and, like, take corrective measures.
Yeah.
Or apologize or whatever the
situation. It's one of those things where you're like, oh, boys will be boys. That's like one of those.
Yeah, boys will be boys as long as we keep letting them be boys.
Yep. And Hermione does take issue with this, but yeah, it's like, you know, they're 14 and fourth years. And if they look anything like they do in the film, their hair is atrocious this year.
Oh my gosh.
So I don't know what Ron is expecting princess to go with him, but.
Ron is not described as being like particularly very handsome or.
Well, nobody's handsome when they're 14.
Right.
But anyway, so they decide, they're like, we're just going to ask people and have dates by the end of the day. So Harry is like, you know what? I'm just going to do it. And he asks Cho to talk for a second. And he like takes her aside from her giggling friends.
This gave me such flashbacks to middle school, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just this whole, yeah. And he asks her to the ball. He asks her. Good on Harry.
Good on Harry.
But she's already got a date.
Yep, she's going with Cedric Diggory.
She's going with Cedric, which, like, Harry...
Like her boyfriend.
Like, yeah, they're like, I don't know if they... We don't really have an exact... Cho and Cedric have started dating casual. Like,
Hermione later will refer to Cedric as Cho's boyfriend.
Yeah, I think, is it... I don't know. Have they been dating? Are they dating after they go to the Yule Ball together?
I don't know.
At some point they start dating. But right. Yeah, she's going with Cedric. And Cedric's, that's awesome. Like, we like Cedric. Cedric's really nice. Good for Cho.
We have no reason. I mean, as far as we know, and he doesn't really ever stumble. Cedric's a very decent stand-up guy.
Yeah, but of course, Harry now has a reason to hate Cedric. Because that's just what happens when the person you like someone else. You just automatically don't like that person.
I know. And it's a shame. Because Cedric really...
And he does something really, really nice great. For Harry at the end of the next chapter. But, and then, you know, Harry gets back to the common room that night and he's, you know, he's upset because Cho's going with Cedric. And he sees Ron and Ginny in the corner and Ron is like looking very weird. He looks like almost catatonic. Harry brings up that he... asked Cho, and there's one line, it says Ginny suddenly stopped smiling.
Yeah, she's very clearly jealous.
I mean, she's always, we've known since we got introduced to her that she's had a crush on Harry, so right. Harry hasn't registered that at all. And Ron was passing by Fleur Delacour and just blurted out asking her to the ball, and he's like freaking out about it. He like kind of ran away before she even said anything, because he's a little bit traumatized. And you know, this is more explained in the book, like the fact that Vila have like this effect on men in particular. They're like walking sirens almost, who don't even have to sing. They dance instead of sing. But I do, like, this is not really explained in the film how the Vila have this like effect on men. And I'm wondering if, like, I mean, we know Ron has a crush on Fleur, but like, I'm wondering if he did this because he was walking by and like, you know, got entranced and just decided to, or if he just was being awkward and a teenager. Yeah,
I think it's twofold, because I think you're right. I think the whole Vila connection is important, and that he might have been like compulsory, like needed to ask her out. But I also think, right, Ron sort of covets popularity, attractiveness,
yeah,
being top tier, and Fleur is kind of all of those things.
Yeah.
Very funny to me to think about this interaction in the grand scheme of things, and the fact that Fleur ends up with Ron's very cool and very attractive older brother.
Yeah.
Bill. Or,
yeah, that kind of sucks for Ron.
Yeah, it does. It does really suck for Ron.
I love Bill and Fleur though. I love Blur. Good ship. Blur. And we find out that Hermione's got a date, because Ginny reports that Neville asked her, and I think Hermione probably would have said yes to Neville. I think she probably would have gone with Neville because they're friends, you know. But she's like, oh, I'm really sorry. Like, I'm actually going with somebody else. And Ron immediately goes to...
Just, no, you're not.
He's a jerk in these next couple chapters. He's like, of course she doesn't have a date. Like, she just didn't want to go with Neville. So she told him no.
And now that was her way of
telling him no. And now she's going to go alone. And it's, you know, you're a loser if you go alone. Meanwhile, Ron doesn't even have a date. Harry has to procure him a date by proxy of his own date. Like,
that he treats like absolute crap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially in the next chapter. But his immediate assumption, and I think this is a little bit of like, you know, there's the seeds of maybe Ron doesn't know it yet, but he's always like his like of Hermione, like romantic feelings for Hermione have like, you know, their start. I don't know if he knows it yet, but he's always, you know, he always sticks up for her. He always if somebody else is teasing her, unless he's teasing her, he's being mean and there's no excuse for it. But I think where this is coming from is his own confusion about his feelings for her.
Absolutely. I mean, they always say, right, like not an adage, but like the sort of stereotype is that you're the meanest to the person that you like and that you have a crush on. And that's like, you know, schoolyard behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very much that. And I think this is the first time that the reader understands like, oh, maybe Ron has some feelings here. He doesn't, you know, quite know how to grapple with and understand, but it's a little bit more apparent to us that, oh, he's jealous. Like, he's, you know, very jealous.
Especially when he sees who she's going with.
Right.
But he immediately assumes she's not going with anybody and she was lying, which is awful.
So jerky.
And then Parvati and Lavender come into the common room and Harry, you know, is like, he kind of treats it like a last resort. He's like, you know, Parvati, will you go with me? And she's like, yeah, definitely. Because she's been sort of, you know, giggling. Him and Lavender have been sitting there giggling about him and Ron for a couple. We've seen a couple classes where they've done that. So Parvati seems excited to go with Harry, actually. And then he turns to Lavender. He's like, do you want to go with Ron? And she's already going with Seamus, which is kind of funny because, you know, her and Ron are going to end up dating. But Harry's like, Parvati, do you know anybody else who will go with Ron? She's like, yeah, I mean, I'll ask my sister. Who's in Ravenclaw, not in Gryffindor in the books.
Right. So then we kind of, you know, get some color on classes and sort of how classes have been. So, you know, there's some teachers who are just like, okay, you're very excited about the Yule Ball and, you know, everything that's upcoming. Like, we're going to kind of chill it on class a little bit. And then we get...
Is this into chapter 23?
This is the end of this chapter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then we kind of, I think, hear a little bit more about some teachers who are really kicking it up in this gear. And so it's the end of this chapter, I believe, where Harry's sitting for his potions final. And he misses something that has to do with the bazaar. Yeah. And just an interesting tidbit, because the bazaar stone is what's going to save Ron's life in a future book.
Yeah. Totally.
Oh, and we see in this chapter that the twins are trying to contact, quote unquote, somebody, who will later find out that somebody is Ludo Bagman.
Right. Yes. There was something else I was going to say. What was I going to say? I don't remember.
I loved the line about Professor Binns, where they're like, he kept teaching through his own death. So the Yule Ball wasn't going to stop him.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. So not in the book that was added into the film was the scene where the heads of house had to gather their house together and teach them how to waltz, which I think was a great addition to the film.
Great scene in the
where
film.
Where we see Maggie Smith like teach all the Gryffindors and, you know, she's got Rupert Grint trying to dance with her. And what's funny about that, because it's not of the books, it's, you know, so it stands to reason that if Professor McGonagall is teaching this to the Gryffindors, is Professor Snape like coming up to Draco Malfoy and being like, put your hand on my waist? Like,
I just imagine like Snape like walking around with like a like a ruler, like tapping students who are like being
their
too
hands
handsy.
Are too low on the girl's back. Yeah, that's funny. And then, like, I mean, I bet Sprout's dance class would be very fun, and I bet Flitwick's dance class, you know, he's a good musician, so
yeah, he's probably, musical, right?
Yeah. Anyway, so I love that addition to the movie, and it just stands, you know, it's funny to think about the other heads of house possibly doing that.
It's the Yule Ball.
And, you know, the Harry and Ron ask Hermione, they're like, oh, like your teeth are looking really good. Like, they look better than before Draco cursed you, because, you know, Hermione was kind of described as like having buck teeth.
Mm-hmm. Very and typical, like, for student for kids, yeah, who have, yeah, not like grown into their age.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't grow into.
I
your
had major buck teeth, so.
No, you didn't.
Mm-hmm. It's very evident in photos.
I'll have to go back and look.
Yeah, I had a gappy smile with buck teeth.
You had a little bit of a gappy. I remember the gappy.
The size of my teeth are pretty big, and I was so small and very petite then. Yeah, so yeah. I just had like a very prominent front two teeth. They were a little bucky, but I grew into them. I don't think,
yes,
I have
you
buck
did.
Teeth
they
now.
Look, they,
yeah,
look beautiful.
Buck teeth are beautiful too. It's, yes, just, yeah, yeah.
But they said, so they're like, wait, Hermione, your teeth look different. And they've seen her since she's seen Madame Pomfrey. So it's kind of weird that they're bringing it up in this chapter, or that the author like forgot to write it earlier. I don't know. And she's like, oh yeah, like when I went to see Madame Pomfrey, she just like, you know, she had her wand and she was like, stop me when they're fixed back to, you know, what they normally look like before this. And I just like kind of let her keep going until they looked really pretty. Just kind of funny.
That's me. And she mentions that because her parents are dentists, they're like very particular about her teeth and they don't want magic messing with them. They want to like continue with her braces. But we don't, yeah, ever have it described that Hermione has braces before.
I thought this too. She's like, you know, my parents want me to stick with my braces. And I don't know if she's referring to like getting braces in the future, because,
or perhaps she has a retainer or something.
Right. It's never said before this that she's had braces.
No. And you think it would have been mentioned at least when her teeth were cursed.
Yeah.
No, it's very strange.
I wrote that too.
So
it's Christmas break. The castle is like really crowded because everyone's staying this year for the ball. And, you know, they've already got more students.
Christmas morning comes about.
Oh, did we already get to Sirius writing back to them? Like Pigwidgeon?
No.
So they had sent a letter to Sirius after the first task. Just Harry was describing that, you know, he got through it and he's alive and here's all the things. He's like, you know, he's giving Sirius the play-by-play and is excited to hear what he has to say about it. And we find out the thing that Sirius was gonna say to get past the dragon, and that was to use the conjunctivitis curse on it. So, like, give a dragon pink eye to get past it. And Hermione's like, oh, that's what Crumb did. That's funny that that's, like, the I didn't know that was, like, a well-known dragon trick.
Yeah, I liked that tidbit.
And he's basically just, like, keep updating me because this is still weird.
Right, and he
whoever
he
put says, your name in is probably not happy that you got through that unscathed.
Right, and he says to Harry, you know, stay vigilant. And Harry says, why does everybody say that to me? Do they think I'm just walking around the castle with my eyes closed, banging into walls? Yeah. And I'm like, yes, you kind of do that, Harry.
You're oblivious. I love sassy Harry. On Christmas morning, Harry wakes up kind of with a start because, like, he wakes up and Dobby's just like leaning over him, staring at him. And Dobby's like, he's like really startled. And, you know, you get kind of frustrated because Dobby doesn't pick up on cues.
No, he's terrible at social cues.
Dobby gets a little sad because he thinks he did something wrong. And he's like, well, Mr. Harry Potter said that I could come see him, sir. Dobby, you are such a pure soul. I love you.
Harry's like, yeah, just prod me awake next time, please.
Yeah, yeah. So Dobby's there on Christmas morning, and he brought Harry a present. He made him some socks, and Harry fished some old socks out of his trunk to give to Dobby.
They were Uncle Vernon, so terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, but Ron gives him the sweater that his mom made for him, because he's like, I have loads of these, Dobby. You can have my
probably
sweater.
Like a huge dress on Dobby.
On Dobby, yeah, exactly. And Harry gets a sweater from Mrs. Weasley, as usual, and his has a dragon on it.
Very
and
cool.
Yeah, which is, it is really cool.
So obviously that it's Christmas, that means it's the day of the Yule Ball.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a few things, I think, about the Yule Ball to mention.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is that in the movies, we see all of the women wearing dresses.
Right.
And all of the men are in these like more wizard specific dress robes.
Yep.
But in the book, it is described as all of the girls also being in dress robes. And so I would have loved a visual on this. Is it more like a fancier version of what McGonagall wears every day to teach, you know, or kind of like what Dumbledore wears, but like maybe more cut to like a woman's body?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I wrote this down too, because I was kind of interested in it, how they're all described as being in dresses and like, or dress robes, and they're all different colors. Like all the girls are wearing different color robes. I don't know if the guys are in different color robes. Certainly Ron's is not the traditional looking. There's also a thing where Dean mentions, he's like, I don't know. He's talking to Harry and Ron, and he's like, I don't know how you two ended up with the best looking girls in our year. Alluding that Padma and Parvati are the best looking girls in their year, which like, go them.
Beautiful. I love that for them. Twins. Yeah,
beautiful Indian twins. Love that. But also like the fact that if they're the two best looking girls in their year, like how come nobody asked them before Harry and Ron did last minute?
I know.
They treat them like poop at this ball.
No, they really do. It's so terrible.
It's awful.
Not good to the girls at
all. As somebody who, if this person is listening, I just want you to know, we're still really good friends and I love this person. But as somebody who like, I went to a dance once with a buddy and, you know, we're friends. It wasn't like, you know, we didn't know each other. I think that would have been worse, but he like left me the entire dance. It was sucky. And then
this initials MS.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't even have to think about that.
Yeah. And it was, so what was funny was,
sorry, MS, if you're listening.
Yeah, we're still really, really good friends and I love him, but
boys are boneheads.
Yeah. And this is like sophomore year and we went to a dance and he like left and like hung out with his buddies the whole time. And I was just a little miffed about it. Wasn't like, I still had a good night, but I was a little miffed about that. And then, you know, our moms were really good friends. So I mentioned it to my mom, who mentioned it to his mom. And then when we went to prom together senior year, he never left my side, which is, we had a really great time. Anyway, but yeah.
I have a similar story. Since we're talking about our cringy dance experiences. Yes. Yeah. So I went to prom my sophomore year with somebody who was older than me. And
I remember this gentleman.
He was a very nice guy. I did not end up like going to the prom after party with that person. This is so mean. I can't believe I'm admitting this on the internet, but I had a huge crush on his best friend.
No, McKenna.
And so I ended up like pretty much dancing all of prom with his best friend.
McKenna.
He didn't want to dance and I really wanted to dance. My mom, I think, later told me that because he had paid for the tickets and it was his prom, I should have just like sat there with him.
Oh.
That would have been more polite, but he didn't want to dance and I like to dance at dances, you know, it's fun. So I danced with his friend the whole night and then he just wanted to go home. So I went to it was like at our school gym, like the prom after party, they had a raffle. I won a printer that year.
It's so bougie.
I know.
And that's on going to high school where you went to high school.
Yeah, I know. I went to high school in an Ivy League college. I was very privileged to have gone to that school. So I think I got karma because the next year, which would have been my junior prom, the year I should have actually gone to prom, like could have bought my own ticket, I had mono and my spleen was enlarged. So my doctor told me that I couldn't go to prom in case somebody hit it while we were dancing. And I was supposed to get up and get ready and like put my clothes on, my dress on, and go at least take pictures with my friends because all my friends were seniors and graduated. Right,
even if you go take pictures, yeah.
Right. And I slept through the whole thing because I had mono. And then my senior year prom, all of my friends were seniors really, and they had already graduated. So I didn't really, like I knew people in my grade, but like all my really good friends in high school had already left. Mm-hmm. And so I asked a friend who was younger than me to go to prom with me. He was like a junior. And we went just as friends and he ditched me at my senior prom.
Karma.
And I was like, who do you know here? These are like upperclassmen. He was a sophomore. That was what it was because he couldn't go to prom himself. But I was like, who do you know here? These are upperclassmen.
That's so, I mean, it's so, not funny, but now it's funny.
So I like really got it like handed right back to me. He ended up like, he couldn't even drive. He didn't know how to drive. And so I drove us to prom and I ended up just driving myself home because he found a ride with like somebody else at prom to go to like some crazy party.
No.
And I just would have never expected it because this guy was like really nerdy. We were in the Teenage Republican Club together, which that's on growth because that's not my political affiliation anymore. No.
I remember those days.
But I was the founding member of the Young Republicans at my high school. Anyway, so that's on cringy dance stories.
If 18-year-old you could see where almost 26-year-old you is now. It's McKenna's birthday this week, you guys.
Yeah, Sunday.
Happy almost birthday.
Thanks. I'm really looking forward to this birthday.
Are you doing anything fun?
I am. I'm going out Saturday to...
McKenna's vaccinated.
I'm actually not vaccinated.
Oh, that's right. No, you're... Oh, right.
But I had COVID and I got an antibody infusion. So I have a lot of antibodies. Like I've been tested.
You have built up... You have immunity.
Yes. Right. I would have had immunity if I had COVID anyway, but I got for 2 hours in the hospital, they pumped antibodies into me to help me fight off the virus because I wasn't doing very well. So I have like extra immunity. So I have sort of been acting at the recommendation of my doctor and the CDC as though I'm, you know, vaccinated in how I'm going out and hanging out and doing things. So, and then as soon as this wears off, I'm eligible to get my vaccine and then I'm going to do that anyway. So just to say, and Aaron is fully vaccinated. So we're very pro vaccine and we really, you know, hope that people make a very good scientific choice for themselves that is science based and not Facebook based. So... They're not the same thing, folks. So anyway, so Saturday I'm going out. There's a distillery in my town that makes amazing local spirits. So we're going to go sit outside with my parents and just play board games and have some cocktails and kind of just like have a easy day. My mom and I are going to get our nails done together in the early afternoon. Oh, I know. I wish you were here. And then we're going to go to a dinner at a place I've always wanted to go. It's like right on the water. It has amazing views of the city. And then Sunday I'm going to wake up and take my grandma to brunch.
How fun.
At the Ritz-Carlton in White Plains. So
I wish I could be there.
Yeah, I wish you could be here too. I'm really excited. I haven't actually been excited for a birthday in a couple of years. And I don't know, I'm just feeling very positive vibes on this birthday.
Good.
So, thanks for mentioning. Good. It was my birthday. I love that.
Yeah. I know your birthday every year. I don't know. I'm really bad at memorizing people's birthdays, but yours is a birthday I've always had memorized.
Right. I mean, we have been friends for a really long time. So like, I'm not really great at birthdays either, but like, I know when your birthday is.
Yeah.
And I know when my husband's birthday is.
Yes.
And I most of the time know when my parents' birthday is.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Harry Potter.
Back to Harry Potter. So, you know, the event starts and all of the champions...
And before that, Ron keeps asking after Hermione. Who's taking her? He keeps asking. Like And then all the champions.
All the champions go in with their dates. I sort of forget. Do they do the dance first and then they sit down at the table and then they dance again?
I think they sit down and then they start the dancing after the dinner.
Because he says before they sit down that she's sort of, maybe they're like processing through the hall because he makes a comment that he's with Parvati, right? Parvati. So he makes a comment that she's sort of walking him through as though he's a show dog.
Yeah. She's like pulling around because she's got a lot of friends to say hi to.
Right. And she's very proud that she's, you know, going to the ball with one of the champions. And I would argue that he should be very proud to be going to the ball with such an attractive young lady who's also very bright and very smart. So, you know, she's really the complete package as all women are. So I am just so mad at Harry for just like the way he right off the bat kind of like has such a negative attitude about her. But then
part of it is he's also like trying to be in solidarity with Ron, who is extra miffed because they both see, so as Harry is processing in with the champions, it's said before he realizes, he's like, you know, Fleur was with Roger Davies, the Ravenclaw captain of the captain of the Ravenclaw Quidditch team, and who Cedric is with Cho, obviously. And then he says, and then he saw Fleur with the, or I'm sorry, Fleur. He saw Crumb with this really pretty girl.
He didn't
recognize. Periwinkle robes that Harry didn't know. At first he doesn't recognize, but then he realizes Crumb is with Hermione.
Right. As he gets closer to them.
Also, I want to mention, we had some discussion on Crumb and Hermione sort of having a little fling this year. I went back and looked. He is 18 years old.
Yes, and somebody messaged us, or somebody left a comment that, oh, she just turned 15.
Oh, like, we had this discussion last time, but...
Right, yeah. We don't really need to rehash this. I do think it's very interesting that people who, like, really do defend the relationship. I'm not necessarily saying that there's anything very wrong with the...
I'll say what I said last time. Behaviorally, it's fine.
Right, he's very polite to her.
He's really polite, very sweet to Hermione. Logistically, there's some, you know, just age difference and the fact that, at least according to the U.S., Crumb is over the age of consent, Hermione is under the age of consent. Logistically, that's a little weird.
I think that age would bother me less if
he wasn't
super, who he is.
An international superstar.
Right. Yeah. And I do think that Hermione's probably the type who writes home a lot and tells her parents about what's going on. And so, like, I'm sure she's, like, explained the situation to them. And I don't know. Hermione just strikes me as the kind of person, if her parents were like, no, that's inappropriate, she would be like, okay, that's inappropriate. I don't know. She just gives me those vibes as somebody who's very respectful
behaviorally,
to her mom and dad.
Crumb is totally nice.
Right. The behavior is fine. It's more, to me, it's the power dynamic.
Yes.
That is a little
absolutely
off. And that I think that even if you have just turned 15, I don't think your little baby brain can handle just the, like, emotional complexities of being with somebody who is literally an international superstar. And so I'm going to stick with that theory.
Yeah,
you can disagree
with you.
Me, but that's where I sit.
I agree with you. So Hermione's with Crumb, and Harry's like, whoa.
They all sit down. Not they all. The champions and Dumbledore.
The headmasters.
Yes.
Yeah, sit
they
down
all
to dinner.
Sit at this sort of, like, long table. Kind of like that table.
I think
at
it's
the
a
wedding.
Circular table, actually.
Oh, is it
yeah.
a circular
it's
table?
Like, I think they said that the big long tables were gone and had been replaced with about 100, like, circular tables to sit at for dinner. Like you see
I
at
thought,
a wedding, you're right.
You
had a long table
were,
at your wedding, though.
I did have a long table at my wedding. I thought that they were, like, sort of at the front at a long table. I don't know why that's what I visualized after reading
maybe.
It.
Maybe. I forget.
Because I thought they, like, mentioned kind of, like, looking down at people who are speaking. Anyway, that's, like, such a small thing. It doesn't matter. So moving on. So they're at this table and they're kind of all speaking.
And Percy's there.
And Percy's there. Yes, he's filling in for Barty Crouch Sr., who was unable to make it because he's not so well. Percy tells us about 75 million times through the next 20 pages about how important he is to Barty Crouch Sr. I love that Harry thinks in his head, like, I wonder if I should ask Percy if Barty Crouch knows his
still
name
still calls
yet.
Him Weatherby. Yeah. So the first thing that Percy says to Harry, he grabs him as Harry's sitting down to, like, sit next to him. And it's not, hi, Harry, how are you doing? Like, I hope you're well. I know this tournament is probably very stressful on you. The first thing out of his mouth is, I got promoted.
I know. It's like,
Percy's a Slytherin. I will die on this hill.
Hi. I don't like that connotation to all Slytherins, but I do agree.
It's not that he's being, he's ambitious.
But Percy is, like, the worst kind of ambitious. Like, just the most annoying type of
but
ambitious.
He is ambitious,
right? Like, I'm ambitious. I don't think I'm, like, that irritating. Maybe I am.
You're not irritating. I'm not saying all people are that irritating, but he's, you know, his main, the first thing out of his mouth is, I got promoted. He
yeah
should have
I
been
mean
Slytherin.
Not,
I will die on this hill.
No, I totally agree that he should be in Slytherin. Most of the Weasleys are sorted incorrectly.
Right.
Just because, like,
it's not
one...
because he's being annoying, it's because he's ambitious.
Yes, right. But he is just, like, when we talk about the Enneagram, like, healthy versus unhealthy, like, Percy would be an unhealthy Slytherin in the same way that Draco is
probably
an unhealthy Slytherin.
Probably, like, I don't know, like, moderately unhealthy three, maybe?
Oh, Percy, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're all sitting at the table. I love that Hermione's trying to teach Crumb how to say her name. And then Crumb is... What's interesting is there's a line in the movie in which Hermione basically says, like, oh, he doesn't talk much. He just likes to watch me study. And we haven't gotten to that if there is
that would
a
be
line
post
Yule
Ball in the film. Yeah.
Right. So I haven't read ahead, so I can't say that that happens because the rest of this book is a little fuzzy except for the major plot events. But
they're having nice conversation at
the center.
He's
talking quite a lot and telling her all about Durmstrang, what the castle's like, and the weather. And, you know, he's being very chatty and very open with her, which is great because he strikes me as somebody who maybe doesn't feel so comfortable with everybody that he meets. And so he's very comfortable with her. And I think that's very sweet. And then Karkaroff.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Go ahead. And then I'll go back to it.
Steps in and says, you know, why don't you like stop giving away all of our secrets about Durmstrang? And then Dumbledore kind of gets involved and they sort of like go back and forth a little bit. And Dumbledore says something to the effect of like, well, I wouldn't even pretend to know all of the secrets and all of the mysteries of Hogwarts. For example, I was walking on my way to the bathroom just today when I encountered a strange room adorned with chamber pots.
I hope the Hogwarts students aren't still using chamber pots.
And when I went back to find that room, it was gone. And this is the first mention of the Room of Requirement. And I find a lot of fault with the author in so many things, but I love the way that this is worked into the book.
Yeah, her Easter egg ability is very good.
Because from an outside perspective, it just sounds like another nutty thing that Dumbledore would say. Mm-hmm. Like book Dumbledore and the way that he is just like so off his rocker.
And the fact that he's off to the bathroom to like use the bathroom, presumably. And then the Room of Requirement has a bunch of chamber pots in it.
Right, he's tired, he's like looking for the bathroom, and then there it is with all the with all the chamber pot. But it sounds like one of those like Dumbledore stories.
Right.
And it's not, it's like really truly one of the, in my opinion, one of the best mysteries of Hogwarts.
Yeah.
One of the coolest things about Hogwarts is the Room of Requirement. It's gonna be really important in the next book. So just a really kind of cool mention here.
Yeah. So I have two other things about that exchange.
Yes.
I think the reason, and I mean, this is brought up, but like, I think the reason that Victor is like enjoying having a conversation with Hermione and talking to her is, and like you said, he doesn't feel super open and comfortable with a lot of people is because when you listen to some celebrity interviews, they're like, well, it's really hard. Like, cause the first thing people think about is like my money and my fame and they don't see me. Right. And I bet that happens to Victor a lot, but Hermione wasn't like after him in the first place just because of his fame. And I think that's what drew him to her, was she like wasn't interested in that. And now she's like, she's enjoying being there with him and she's interested in like him. So that's got to be nice for him and probably nice for him to like be able to open up to a person. Back to the thing about Karkaroff, like not exactly knowing where he's from. Usually when a person has an accent, the author will write it in. So like Fleur, there is accent writing of like her French accent. Victor, there's accent writing for his sort of Slavic Bulgarian accent. But Karkaroff, there's no like accent writing. So does he have a British accent? Like, we don't know.
No, that's a really interesting point.
Just posing a question. I don't know. I don't know that he's necessarily from England, but like there's no accent writing. Don't know. No idea. But going on, I think this was probably the first time when Hermione is like teaching Crumb how to pronounce her name properly. This is the first time we're getting like a phonetic explanation about how Hermione should be said. And I can't remember if the first movie had come out by this point when this book had been published. But I just know that, you know, some of the fans who were reading the books as they were coming out, when the first movie came out and they said Hermione's name, they're like, I fully have been saying that wrong in my head the whole time I've been reading this. So I wonder if some people had that realization when she was like teaching Crumb to pronounce it Hermione. Rather than Hermione. Yes. And then it's time to start the dancing and the weird sisters come out on stage. I want to read off the instrumentation for this band because it's so kooky and fun. Let me find it. It's on page 419 in my book. So the Weird Sisters troop, blah, blah, blah. The set of drums, several guitars, a lute, which is like a medieval string instrument, a cello, and some bagpipes. Like, this is a very interesting instrumentation for a band to have.
It is a very strange.
But
very, I mean, cool. you would know more than me, but very, very interesting.
You know what that instrumentation makes sense for? Like a folk, like an Irish trad or folk music band. But the lute's kind of funny.
Right. So back to the Yule Ball, right?
Yeah. So they're dancing now.
Yes. Ron is just such an insufferable git during this whole night.
Yes, he is.
Like, he's so unfair to Padma. He's just, he's even like, I think, I don't know, he's obviously very unfair to Hermione, and just, it's just so terrible. And I think like to Harry a little bit too, because I could see Harry like letting loose and enjoying the night if Ron had like any semblance
been
of
such a pill
wanting to do the same. Yeah. Right. And so their dates end up leaving them for.
But there are two quick things about the initial dance, if I may interject.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is there's this line, and I know this is from Harry's perspective, but the author is writing this. He's talking about Madame Maxime dancing with, I think, Dumbledore at this point. She moved gracefully for a woman so large. Again, as a tall woman? Ouch!
I know, it's terrible.
Rude!
It is rude.
And then, the other thing, Moody is dancing and says to Harry, nice socks, which are hidden under his pants. So we have seen Moody look through the invisibility cloak. Now we know that Moody's eye can see through clothing.
That's disturbing.
And Parvati points it out. She's like, you know, that's really creepy. Like, that eye should not be allowed. And she's right. Can he see through clothing? This is not even Alistair Moody. This is Barty Crouch Jr. Which, like, that's bad for any adult man to be able to look through people's clothing. But, like, right. Extra creepy when it's a Death Eater. So then after this first dance, Harry and Parvati go sit to find Ron and Padma, who are sitting down. And Padma looks miserable, poor girl.
Right. She ends up leaving with her sister with a couple of guys from Beauxbatons to go have a great rest of her night.
Yep.
And then, you know, Hermione meets up with Ron and Harry. Ron gives her a tremendous amount of grief. She runs off.
Victor is off. Quote, quote, fraternizing with the enemy, which is put in the film too.
She runs off. Victor comes over with their drinks. You know, Ron is just rude to him. And then I love the moment, Hermione says it in the film, but it's actually Percy who says it in the books, like, oh, I see you're speaking with Crumb. Like, that's what this is all about. International magical cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hermione does have that.
And Ron is just like, oh.
So then Harry and Ron, like, get up and go for a walk.
Yes.
And they overhear some interesting conversations.
Yes, I have it pulled up.
Yeah, the first one is Snape and Karkaroff, right?
Right, so I have it pulled up in the book. So they're outside near the fountains, along off the paths near the rose bushes. And he hears a familiar voice, which is revealed to be Snape. Don't see what there is to fuss about, Igor. And Severus, you cannot pretend this isn't happening. Karkaroff's voice sounded anxious and hushed, as though keen to not be overheard. It's getting clearer and clearer for months. I am becoming seriously concerned. I can't deny it. Then flee, said Snape's voice curtly. Flee. I will make your excuses. I, however, am remaining at Hogwarts. Snape and Karkaroff came around the corner. This is like such...
That's a bombshell. We just don't know it yet.
It's a bombshell, right. So forget about what Ron and Harry think of this moment for a minute. I mean, we know Karkaroff is a former Death Eater.
We know Snape is a former Death Eater.
Do we know Snape is a former Death Eater at this
point?
Oh,
we don't.
No, we don't. The boys don't know.
Oh, really?
I don't think the boys know.
I don't remember.
Oh, maybe Sirius revealed it to them. Prisoner of Azkaban. Google it right now.
I don't remember if they know that yet. Didn't they? Oh my gosh, this is really bad. I can't remember if they would know that at this point. Well, we know that.
It's not until Harry falls in the Pensieve in Dumbledore's office.
Oh,
so okay. So right
later
now,
this year, I think.
Right. So right now, they know No, they don't know Karkaroff is a former Death Eater.
No, they do. Sirius told them.
Yes, Sirius has told them that Karkaroff is a former Death Eater. They just know that Snape is just always suspicious. Like, he doesn't like the students very much. He's very close with Dumbledore.
He's shifty.
And he's a little shifty, right? Like, that's the whole point of his character. He's written to be that way, and she does it well. When he says, Karkaroff, Severus, you cannot pretend this isn't happening. It's been getting clearer and clearer for months. What he's referring to is the dark mark on his arm, that it's been growing. obviously because Voldemort's return is imminent, and Karkaroff doesn't, he's already been through the whole, like, getting caught by the Aurors, going to, like, Azkaban, like, he's already faced, like, this punishment or, like, potential punishment for being a Death Eater. He doesn't want to be involved again, you know. No. I think he has a good position where he's at, he's comfortable, he got off once, like, he was never a fanatic in the way
and he didn't look back. Yeah, he got off, he, like, gave up people's names and he didn't look back. And we're gonna see that in the next couple chapters. Well, I don't know,
right, if it's
the next couple chapters actually.
We're gonna see it. Well, I mean, we're halfway through the book at this point, so it's a coming. Mm-hmm. And Snape says, flee, I'll make your excuses, however, I am remaining at Hogwarts.
Yeah.
And this is just such, like, it's three paragraphs, and it's just so important. Like, Karkaroff's confused as to why Snape doesn't have the same worry, and why he's not going to run, why he's going to stay at Hogwarts, where potentially the Dark Lord could find him if he's coming back and re-recruit him into the ranks, which is going to happen. But of course, Snape is going to stay at Hogwarts, not because he's looking forward to the imminent return of the Dark Lord, or that he's fanatically wanting to go back into being a Death Eater, but because he's bound to, mm-hmm, by his pact with Dumbledore and the work, yep, that he's doing with Dumbledore. And it's just, yep, three paragraphs that are so important for the whole story. And it's just, it's so interesting. And it also made me think, would Snape have the dark mark, and would it be growing, and would he have told Dumbledore that prior to him figuring, you know, prior to him speaking with Karkaroff? Like, I assume he has the dark mark. He was a prominent Death Eater in his time.
Yeah, he would have the dark mark, and it probably he'd probably be feeling the same thing.
Right.
Interesting. So that probably adds to, I mean, and, like, you know, Dumbledore's had this sense that Voldemort's coming back for a long time now, and that's probably part of their conversations. That is a really interesting point.
In which case, I imagine Moody would have been included on those conversations, which then would be impacting what he's teaching the students. Like,
oh.
But of course, Moody is really imposter Moody.
Very interesting point.
And of course, David Tennant would have, or David Tennant.
David Tennant.
Just who he is in my mind.
Synonymous with Barty Crouch Jr.
Barty Crouch Jr. like would have already known, because he's been involved with the Dark Lord. And so it's just such an interesting dynamic, right? Because if Snape tells Dumbledore and Dumbledore tells Moody, Barty Crouch Jr. would know that Snape would be sort of selling Voldemort out.
Oh, crap.
Right? So can Snape not
tell? Oh, crap, you're right.
Dumbledore, but Snape doesn't know that Moody is imposter Moody. Like, this is sort of a weird plot hole here, because,
oh my gosh, you're so right.
Right. Because when Snape rejoins the Death Eater ranks, he's welcomed back, and Voldemort's happy to have him, and he, you know, rises to prominence again, and is not shamed, I think, in the same way that, like, somebody like Lucius Malfoy is shamed for not looking for the Dark Lord.
So I think here's my question would be this. Is Crouch, because Crouch gets apprehended at the end of the year, Crouch Jr.,
right,
Moody in quotes, gets apprehended at the end of the year. Is he in contact with, like, Wormtail or Voldemort, or is he, like, not taking the risk? But you would think that would be information that would be kind of pertinent, that he would be like, I need to send an owl.
Right. And he's maybe in the graveyard. Okay.
So I think the real question is Dumbledore giving up Snape as a source for this information? Because Dumbledore could be relaying this information to, quote, quote, Moody, but not revealing that Snape is the source.
Right. But there's only two potential sources. I don't think that Karkaroff would tell Dumbledore. I don't think he would have that level of trust in Dumbledore. And
right, but Dumbledore has a lot of allies everywhere.
Yes, that's true.
That's a really interesting question, McKenna.
Right. And then, like, how is Snape just hiding his dark mark on his... I mean, we know he wears his robes and, you know, but, like, what... I don't want to say a burden, because he's the idiot who has a dark mark because of his involvement anyway, but, like, what a load to bear, you know, that it's on his arm, that it's growing, and he is playing the double agent.
And I'm sure it's a reminder when he looks at it of, like,
what he gave up.
He's part of the reason that, you know, the person he loved is dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awkward. We got to get to one more conversation in this chapter, and that is Harry and Ron like sneak off and end up hiding in a bush because Ron is trying to avoid seeing Fleur Delacour after the snafu of like asking her, and they hide in a bush or behind something. I don't know. And they overhear a conversation between Hagrid and Madame Maxime. And Hagrid is like trying to ask Madame, he's like trying to get her to open up because he's like, you're like me. I like knew it when I saw you. And they're like, where is this going? And Harry feels bad about eavesdropping on this, but Ron's just like, we just got to get away from Fleur. And Hagrid, I forgot that this is the first time in the books that it's revealed that Hagrid is half giant.
Right.
And he basically asks her, he's like, you're half giant too. And she's like, no, how dare you say that? I'm big boned.
Right.
She like walks away. She like doesn't want to admit it.
Can I say another thing about this conversation?
Yes. It's probably what I think it's going to be. Go ahead.
Right. So it says Harry definitely didn't want to listen to this. He knew Hagrid would hate to be overheard in a situation like this. He then goes on to consider putting his finger in his ears and humming loudly, but that wasn't really an option. Instead, he tried to interest himself in a beetle crawling across the stone reindeer's back, but the beetle wasn't interesting enough to block out Hagrid's next words.
So there's a beetle.
And I mean, we do spoilers on this podcast, so I think we can say that beetle is Rita Skeeter in Animagus form, which is why she's been able to sneak into the campus and why she always can have the scoop, even if it's very misconstrued.
Yeah. And this brings us into, and it's going to go on into the next chapter, this conversation about the race of giants, who we haven't heard a ton on yet. And Ron is sort of in this position again of holding all these sort of
prejudices
because he's grown up in the wizarding world, and it's like the common misconceptions about giants. Like, from our perspective, the characters we talk to say that giants are evil, they just enjoy killing people, mm-hmm. and they're like just bad. But I can also, you know, you can also see how that would be probably the societal takeaway when you're looking at a creature who is just big and scary looking, and you automatically assume that they are bad and evil because they are different and scary looking.
But of course, you can be critical thinkers, and we can juxtapose that prejudice against everything that we know about Hagrid, and that he is literally one of the most gentle, loving, caring, sweet people in Harry's life.
Right. And we're going to meet another very sweet giant later on.
Also, Madame Maxime, like, there's nothing wrong with her. She's not prone to killing.
This is another instance of like when we get to see a little bit of, I don't know if we would call it racism or species is in the wizarding world. Mm-hmm. And it's awful. It's like, and Hermione, well, this is in the next chapter, spoiler. Hermione is comparing it. She's like, the way you're talking about giants is like the way that we heard people talk about werewolves, and you know, Professor Lupin's delightful,
right? Or like, the way we hear Death Eaters talk about muggles.
Muggleborns, exactly. This chapter, do you have anything else to say on that?
No, I was just gonna say this chapter ends with Harry going back into the entrance hall, Hermione saying goodnight to Crumb, and Harry hears somebody calling him halfway up the staircase. It's Cedric Diggory, and you know, Cedric leaves Cho. I think that's like a knife in Harry's heart that he knows she's up there waiting for him. And he says to, you know, did you open the egg? Like, I owe you one for telling me about the dragons. And he says, go take a bath and take the egg with you and just mull things over in the hot water. It'll help you think. And Harry's just staring at him, probably like, baths?
It's weird.
And Cedric says, tell you what, use the prefect's bathroom. Password's Pine Fresh. And he runs back off to
the common room where Harry and Hermione are yelling at each other.
Right.
This is in the film, the conversation we see happening on the staircase where Hermione's like crying. It doesn't say she's crying in the book, but Ron and Hermione are like going back and forth at the end of the night. This actually takes place in the common room in the book.
And the last paragraph is that after their fight, Harry didn't say anything. He liked being back on speaking terms with Ron too much to speak his mind. And this is just an instance where I really wish Harry
would have stuck up for Hermione.
just put Ron in his place for, in general, like all the insensitivity and terribleness that he caused for the night. And it's, I know like Ron really matures into a good character and there's a lot of pluses to Ron, but absolutely, it's this very continued childish behavior that like really makes me not the biggest Ron fan.
Right. And Ron's like, you know, you can be good and make mistakes and, you know, wrong people. Right. I think Ron is very good. I think this is stemming from his place of, you know, liking Hermione and not knowing it and not knowing why he's so jealous and like wants to like give her grief for going with Crumb. And
he makes a lot of the same mistakes over and over again.
Yes. Yes, he does. But like, that's human. But it's like, not to excuse his behavior, he's acted awful tonight. Right. And to take responsibility for it.
Right.
Anyway, those are our chapters 20 through 22, 3?
Yeah, 20.
No, 20. Yeah, 21 through 23.
21 through 23. So we'll pick this back up at 24, which is about Rita Skeeter. And then we get into the second task.
I want to point out that at this point, we would have been done with Prisoner of Azkaban because it only has 22 chapters.
I know. This and is we a are really halfway through haul. This book. And the sad thing is it's really not going to get any shorter as we keep going through these books. So thanks for sticking with us. Like always, if you have any comments or thoughts or you want to like drop us a line, we love that, especially when you guys just share your theories with us. Those are some of the best kind of comments that we have. We are working on potentially rolling out a Patreon, hopefully in the next few months, with lots of MCU content. I think that's the current plan. And it really helps us out if you like us on Apple Podcasts and give us a little bit of a rating, preferably 5 stars is always the best rating, but it just helps boost our podcast to other listeners. And share us with your friends and your family and any other Harry Potter nerds in your life.
Yeah. That's it. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. I'll be a year older. Thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram @thedailyprofcast to DM us or leave us an email. Thank you.